Hello, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know, addressing community oncologist questions about the current and future management of endometrial cancer. My name is Shannon Weston, and I will be your moderator today. And here are our esteemed faculty. To my right, Dr. Flor Backus from the Ohio State University, and Dr. Brian Slomovitz from Mount Sinai Medical Center. And we have already agreed we are going by first names tonight. Is that right? All right. And these are our disclosures. And here's the commercial support for today. Please note that the Research to Practice CME Planning Committee staff and reviewers have no COIs to disclose. This program will contain discussion of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. Please refer to official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. In order to make this meeting more relevant to participants, a survey of 25 general medical oncologists and 25 gynecologic oncologists was conducted earlier this month. Questions and cases provided during that survey will be posed to our faculty throughout the meeting. This is where we're headed today. Dr. Backus will start us off with current upfront chemoimmunotherapeutic approaches for advanced endometrial cancer. I'll take on current and the future role of anti-PD-1 and PD-L1 antibodies in combination with systemic therapies beyond chemo for advanced endometrial cancer. And then Dr. Slomovitz will take us home with promising agents under investigation for endometrial cancer. So let's get started. Floor? Great. Yeah, let's give her, yeah, I like it.
That's good. Hopefully you'll still clap after I'm done too. So let's start. So I was tasked with these objectives. So we're going to be discussing the endometrial cancer molecular subtypes, review the implications for prognosis and therapeutic decision making. We'll go over first-line treatment for advanced and recurrent endometrial cancer and look at some of the biomarkers for immune checkpoint inhibition, and then some ongoing first-line studies in dMMR endometrial cancer. So looking back over the many, many years that we've looked at endometrial cancer, we've really kind of looked at prognosis as divided by stage, FIGO 2009, and histologies in P. And this is from the PMMR data from endometrial cancer from the KEYNOTE-B21 study. And here you see that stage is obviously a great differentiator for progression-free survival, as is as there are different outcomes in all these different endometrial subtypes. But even, for example, within serous endometrial cancer, there's more. Serous uterine cancers are 10% of all endometrial cancer. They represent 40% of the death. 75% have a P53 alteration. And then 18 to 42% have HER2 overexpression or amplification of ERBB2. When Britt Erickson did this really nice study, this looked at stage 1 uterine serous cancers. And of these, 26% were HER2 positive, either by IHC or by FISH. And we saw that those patients who were HER2 positive had a 50% recurrence rate versus about 17%. And that was despite the fact that 70% of all these patients received chemotherapy. So HER2, even within serous uterine cancer, is associated with a worse progression-free survival and overall survival. Fortunately, we do have agents that we can target that, such as trastuzumab and pertuzumab, which are humanized monoclonal antibodies against HER2. And then we have trastuzumab deruxtecan and also another investigational agent, trastuzumab paramitecan. Both those are HER2-targeting ADCs. And you're probably all familiar with it. For those who are not, about almost 15 years ago, the Tumor Genome Atlas looked at this and took all these patients with endometrial cancer and discovered that there were really four distinct endometrial cancer subgroups. POLE, mismatch repair deficient, or microsatellite instability, or MSI high, hypermutated tumors. Then we had the copy number low, or endometrioid-like tumors, and then the copy number high, or serous-like tumors. And all of these different subsets came with some different features in mutations, neoantigens, They also saw a different survival. You can see that in the right upper corner. The blue line, and on the screen, you can see it a little bit better. So the poly are the ones that do the best, and then those uterine serous cancers in the red or the serous light, the copy number high, do the worst. But over time, we've added to this. It's not just those four molecular subtypes, which we can see here in the inner circle. On the left side, we see more low-grade. On the right side, we see more high-grade. But now we also see that those are associated with different mutation panels. P10 inactivation is more on that low-grade side, but also we see PIK3CA, beta-catenin, FGFR, ARID1A activation, mutations in the KRAS, RAS-RAF pathway. And on the right side, we see more of that HER2 overexpression, P53 mutations, cyclin E amplification. But on top of all of those factors, we also have to think about these other factors, which can be either mutation or other panels or IHC, such as P53, PD-L1 now, HER2, IHC in fish, TROP2, folate receptor alpha, B7H4, homologous recombination deficiency, which Dr. Weston will talk a little bit more about. So lots more things to consider. And as we're learning more, endometrial cancers really, they have different flavors, different types, even though it's all endometrial cancer, just as these were all apples. And really where we first learned that these tumors also, these subcategories also acted different was from the PORTEC-3 study. So when they divided it out, and this study compared external beam radiations, pelvic radiation versus chemo and radiation plus carboplatin and paclitaxel, they saw that the response to the benefit of the addition of chemotherapy to radiation was mainly in the P53 abnormal population with a hazard ratio of 0.52, but not so much in the polymutated or mismatch repair deficient population, and a mild, somewhat still of a benefit in a no specific molecular profile or NSMP group. And we saw kind of the same shift when we started checking immunotherapy in a mismatch repair deficient population. We saw high response rates in the between 40 and 50%, but whereas in the mismatch repair proficient or microsatellite stable population, we saw that response rate was only in the low teens. And it makes sense because these tumors look different under the microscope too when we look at it. Both the poly and the MSI high tumors are associated with significantly increased predicted neoepitopes, and those also attract to increased numbers of CD3 positive and CDH positive tumor infiltrated lymphocytes compared to those MSS tumors, which we can see in these figures here and in the graphs here. And so those are the poly and MSI tumors for that reason also are really good candidates for immunotherapy. And so immunotherapy by itself worked, but we wanted to include more patients. So we started combining immunotherapy with chemotherapy with the hopes that we could decrease the number of myeloid-derived suppressor cells, increase antigen cross-presentation after immunogenic cell death, increase the dendritic cell activity through STAT6 pathway, increase that ratio of cytotoxic lymphocytes to regulatory T cells, and then create also some more antigenic diversity in tumors by causing that DNA damage and releasing tumor-associated antigens. And so that was kind of the rationale for all these studies that combined chemotherapy and immunotherapy. And we can see this in the table here, and we don't have enough time to go through all these trials in detail, but there are some differences between them. Yes, most of them enrolled, or all of them enrolled, either recurrent endometrial cancer or metastatic endometrial cancer. Most of those had to have measurable, but there were some that allowed non-measurable disease. The timing from last chemotherapy was different. It was either greater than 6 or greater than 12 months. All of the trials gave chemotherapy and then continued, combined that with immunotherapy and followed it by immunotherapy maintenance. But there was a difference in the duration of the maintenance therapy. Some were up to, or GY018 was just 2 years, Ruby did it 3 years, and then DuoE and Attent both continued immunotherapy to progression. There was a difference in primary endpoint and statistical design. And really an important takeaway is that really GY018 or KEYNOTE-868 is the only one that was separately powered for the pMMR and the dMMR populations. And then another thing that came into play, which we learned later, is that also these populations made a little bit of a difference as where we recruited our patients from. So the good thing, though, was as we did these trials, we saw that in recurrent dMMR endometrial cancer, chemotherapy with the addition of immunotherapy, regardless of which type it was, had a very consistent benefit with a hazard ratio of around 0.3. So a 70% improvement in progression-free survival or decreased risk of 70% decreased risk of recurrence or death across all these trials. And now also we see that the overall survival benefit that we see in these populations is sustained even now 4 years later in this dMMR population. In the RUBY population, we see at 4 years a progression-free survival of about 73% versus 40%. In GY018, it is 78 or 79% versus 60%. The numbers are slightly different. The hazard ratios are slightly different, but the trend is the same. There's also differences in the population and the amount of crossover. Around 55%, follow-up is a little bit different, and the information fraction is a little bit different. So we can't really say that any of these trials, one's better than the other. Populations make a big difference, and the follow-up treatment is different. When we look at the pMMR population, we saw across most of these trials also that there was an improvement in progression-free survival. As the ratios, again, here are slightly different, 0.57 in GY018, around 0.7 for DOE, when we compare chemotherapy versus chemotherapy with durvalumab. And then in RUBY, it was also around 0.76. The only one that's kind of an outlier here is that there wasn't any benefit in the ATTEND trial, which used atezolizumab. When we look at overall survival then, in the pMMR population, median overall survival in RUBY was about 4 years of follow-up here. We see median overall survival was 34 versus 27 months. And in GY018, which was just presented on Friday, a median overall survival of 44 versus 35% with a hazard ratio of 0.84. So approaching statistical significance, but not quite there. So we see these curves are favorable. And again, this is despite a very high crossover in both of these trials, meaning that a lot of these patients in the placebo group all went on to receive immunotherapy later on. Here's just an overview for you. This is for progression-free survival, the hazard ratios for the dMMR versus the pMMR. And we see that in a dMMR group, they're very consistent. In the pMMR, we see some differences. And why do we see those differences across these trials? Is it because if we have different population? That may play a big role. In ATTEND and in DOE, we saw 20 to 28% Asian population, where that was very small population, GY018 and RUBY, and that was the population that didn't seem to have a positive benefit in a DMR, except for in a dMMR population. Was there a lower clinical efficacy of drugs across the population? And was it maybe have to do something with the PD-1 versus PD-L1 and what was the molecular breakdown? So in RUBY-D, we did a molecular breakdown, and this was done by whole exome sequencing. And we see that there's a benefit here, not just in the dMMR population, but also in that P53 mutated population with a hazard ratio of 0.55, not so or 0.77 in the NSMP group. And in overall survival, when they did the same follow-up in overall survival, that looked very similar to the progression-free survival. We have to be cautious, though, because this doesn't seem to be the same outcome in all the different studies. In the MITO-ENT3 with avelumab, P53 mutation had a poor effect of avelumab, while RUBY showed the opposite. And then in DUO-E, we see that if you add durvalumab to chemotherapy, yes, we see a benefit, but we see that benefit across P53 mutated and P53 wild type. The hazard ratio is not as pronounced as in RUBY. And if you add a laparop on top of that, we see again that there's a benefit for the P53 mutated and P53 wild type as well. Lastly, I think a really important question, and where are we going to go? If the benefit of immunotherapy is that great with a hazard ratio of 0.3, do these patients with mismatch repair deficient endometrial cancer still need chemotherapy? So there's three trials that are looking at it, KEYNOTE C93 and DOMINICA. Both of these compared chemotherapy to immunotherapy by itself. They have completed enrollment, but they haven't read out yet, so we're anxiously awaiting these results. And then LEAP-001 compared chemotherapy to chemotherapy with lenvatinib. This included DMMR and PMMR populations, and that one is the only one who's read out. So we'll talk just for a moment, and I don't want to steal all your thunder, but here's a PFS in the DMMR population. We see here the green line is lenvatinib with pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy, which is, of course, currently not our standard anymore in the DMMR population. But we see here that the hazard ratio is 0.62. So even without chemotherapy, without immunotherapy, we see here a significant benefit, both in progression-free survival and in overall survival. So we'll kind of have to start comparing these hazard ratios and do a little bit of cross-trial comparisons, but we'll see what the other trials show. So lastly, my conclusions. So molecular profiling has prognostic and predictive implications. Across most of these subsets, there is a benefit of immunotherapy in addition to chemotherapy. We lack a good, strong, predictive biomarker, though, other than just mismatch repair status or MSI. Certainly, we're awaiting those results, whether that first-line chemotherapy remains necessary in a DMMR population, but we have other exciting things to look forward to.
Great job. So we've got all these great questions from, now we're starting to get questions from you all, too, so we'll try to incorporate those as well. But these are really case-based discussions, so I'd really like to have a little chat about all of these because I think they're very relevant. Like, what are we seeing in the clinic when you go back and start seeing patients tomorrow? So this is a 42-year-old woman with metastatic endometrial cancer, MMMR proficient, started on carboplatin and paclitaxel and dostarlimab with a complete radiologic response. So let's kind of get started first. Brian, I'll start with you. What are the biomarker assays do you generally perform or recommend for newly diagnosed endometrial cancer? Do you, want to figure out that molecular subtype that Floor just talked about, and what are you looking for?
Yeah, no, thank you for that question. So in general, specifically in our newly diagnosed patients with endometrial cancer, we're doing MMR testing, MLH1, MSH2, PMS2, MSH6. We're doing ERPR testing. Mm-hmm. I would say P53 mutational status is important. And for the patients with advanced or metastatic disease, I'd probably include HER2 as well because of the way, different ways to exploit that pathway. Yeah. I will just one comment with this. People say, well, a lot of these are just you do surgery on them quickly, and they're not. Why worry about the molecular pathway? Remember, the MMR staining is also a triage tool for Lynch syndrome. Mm-hmm. So not only the treatment implications, but also for hereditary syndrome. So it's important to do that.
What are your thoughts on POLE?
That's a great question, because I eliminated that. POLE mutations or POLE testing is when you look at the NCCN guideline, it's the first test in the hierarchical testing. In many institutions in the U.S., they don't have in-house POLE testing. It's a send-out lab. So there's a cost associated with it.
Right.
I will do POLE testing when it changes what I'm going to do from a treatment perspective. But right now, there's nothing I will do. The Rainbow trial has an arm looking at de-escalating care mm-hmm. for those with POLE mutations. As soon as that's reported, and if it means something, I'll report it out. But right now, I don't do it.
Yeah, especially for somebody like this, this advanced stage where you know you're going to want to give treatment at this point. Yeah. And Flora, you talked a little bit about the different timing for IO. What do you do in this setting? If you have a patient with complete radiographic response, how long are you going to continue IO in this patient?
So you saw on that table, there's a variety. I would say for most patients, I'll continue 2 years. Obviously, according to label, for the pembrolizumab, dostarlimab, we can continue for 3 years. We didn't really see a lot of difference in benefit here. So if the patient, it kind of depends on the patient in that case, too. And we have a discussion at 2 years, should we stop now? And I'll probably be in favor of stopping at that point. But some of these patients actually some want to come off and some really don't want to come off, and then we can continue.
What if there's residual disease, Brian? Does that change what you do?
Yeah, if there's residual disease, I would keep it on for the length of time. You know, the Pembro 2 years, Ruby 3 years, your study indefinitely. For those that don't, and this is predicting the future, now you're passionate about this, maybe ctDNA in the future
right.
is going to play a role in how long we maintain maintenance therapy.
I hope so. Well, let's go to this next case. I think it's really interesting. It's a 48-year-old woman with PMMR, metastatic endometrial cancer, malignant ascites, and peritoneal mets. She's treated with carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, followed by lenvatinib and pembrolizumab upon progression. So for patients with mismatch repair proficient endometrial cancer with ascites, would you administer chemo bevacizumab first line or chemo IO? And can Bev be combined with upfront chemo IO regimens for patients like this who might benefit? I don't know, Brian, do you want to tackle this one first?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. In my talk, I'll show a little bit of data, P53 mutated,
yeah.
the benefits of bevacizumab. I like carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab. I think it's a good regimen. So especially with the ascites, I think it's a good option for her. Maybe another option, if you're really passionate about getting IO in, would be giving dose dense Taxol to get that metronomic effect of maybe a little anti-angiogenic. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think this patient would really benefit from bevacizumab. I think it's okay. You went through it. I'm sure we'll talk more. In DMMR patients, IO is the treatment option.
100%.
In PMMR like this, it's a treatment option. So there's other...
Right. Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit more about those kind of things. You know, is there anything else like you use, Fleur, to help decide between this besides maybe an ascites or symptoms like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this patient has two options. She can, or three options, really, but at least two. The carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab, I think, is definitely a good option for somebody who has a lot of ascites. We've seen that in the MITO studies, that there is some benefit here. You refer to the P53 mutated patients from other studies that you're going to highlight. IO would also be a good option. At this point, I wouldn't combine it, but this would be an ideal candidate to put on an NRG GY035 trial that's currently enrolling and comparing that chemo with bevacizumab, chemo with pembrolizumab, or chemotherapy with bevacizumab and pembrolizumab. So I think this is hopefully going to give us that answer.
It's a great point. So that's a great trial to hopefully have it open at your institution, which will maybe start to answer some of these questions. So, different patient, 62-year-old woman with recurrent endometrial cancer that's mismatch repair deficient, started on single-agent pembrolizumab. After four cycles, she reports new-onset diarrhea, so 4 to 5 loose stools a day, fatigue, and a mild rash on her trunk. Her thyroid function tests show an elevated TSH. So, I mean, this is kind of a broad-based question about, you know, how should we be managing these immune-related adverse events? And Brian, I'll have you kind of kick us off there.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, these are, fortunately, the more and more we use pembrolizumab, the more comfortable we are in assessing these and treating these. You know, it gets a little bit confusing when using pembro and lenvatinib, because then you're not sure which one's causing the diarrhea.
Right.
But I think in this patient, you know, 4 to 5 loose stools per day, I'm aggressive with a multidisciplinary approach. Getting GI involved, steroid, of course, you know, can help her out tremendously. Things like that, as far as the thyroid functions, a lot of times these patients will acquire replacement.
Yeah, and I mean, I think withholding immunotherapy for that patient is really essential, right? You need to pause the immunotherapy, get things back under control, and like Brian said, with diarrhea, you do not want to get behind. And so if you can get somebody to reduce those numbers of stools with oral steroids without having to come into the hospital, that's ideal. But if they're not responding to those oral regimens, then you need to pop that up to IV and maybe even consider other drugs that, like vedolizumab, things like that, that might really help get things stopped.
One more thing
on
this. Of course, you're going to rule out that there's an infectious cause too before starting her on a steroid course. But sometimes we get that question or I see referrals that, oh, her thyroid function, her thyroid TSH is elevated, mm-hmm. I'm going to hold pembro. And we really don't need to do that. I think the audience probably you all know that. We're just going to continue treating and then treat the with levothyroxine, but that's more symptomatic treatment, whereas definitely better with the diarrhea. And if we're concerned about colitis, or rash, fatigue, or some kind of adrenal issues, we certainly want to hold it.
Yeah. And I think I know the answer from all of you about this, but if there are any situations that you would potentially save IO, so a patient that's mismatch repair deficient that you're giving upfront treatment to, would you ever save IO for another line? Floor, you want to start?
Mismatch repair deficient? No.
Yeah.
There's not, yes, no. Not with, this pronounce of a study. You know, this, and I didn't really point that out in my talk, kind of for the lack of time, but I think it is a really important thing that you bring up, saving that for second line. So those studies showed in progression-free survival and overall survival benefit despite a crossover of over 55%, and actually of the patients that were that received further treatment at the time of progression, 93% of those patients continued on to receive immunotherapy in a future as part of a future regimen. And despite them receiving it later, they still had maintained that overall survival benefit. So that just really shows like how important it is that you don't save it, that you give it up front. And because if you save it later, you haven't rescued them. You haven't even those overall survival curves.
It's so, really, yes. Really important data.
I'm going to see if I could challenge you guys on that.
Uh-oh.
So if she has, you know, one or two spots of disease in her lung or her liver, she has a performance status of zero, her tumor's ER positive, strongly ER positive, and she has a normal quality of life, and she just doesn't want to come in. She just wants to do everything and be as normal as possible. I don't think it's stretching too far to start on a course of hormones. And I'll tell you two reasons. One, hormones could work and they're cytostatic. Mm-hmm. But secondly, and more importantly, if you do this, you could stay with indications and not give her chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. Right? You could give the IO single agent second line. If it's my family member, I'd probably give her IO up front. But there may be, you know, everyone's a little bit different. That may be a situation that you could...
I mean, you're always going to have a discussion with the patient and work with what they want. But I think the data are fairly strong to encourage us to use those IOs. And then anybody that you can't give, any like autoimmune diseases, any people with prior transplants, any times that you think, gosh, this is tough, I can't give immunotherapy to this patient. Brian, I don't know. What do you
think? Yeah, I mean, it happens. To your point, the autoimmune diseases, we want to be really super careful. If there's a question about the severity or if she's going to tolerate it, you know, we could always try, but we'd be prepared to stop it. But for the most part, you know, a lot of those patients may be IO ineligible.
Yeah, and you can work very closely. A lot of times transplant physicians are amazing and they'll work with you to help, you know, try to figure out a way to potentially get a patient a life-saving treatment. So definitely that multidisciplinary connection that we can have is really essential. Okay, one more. 52-year-old patient with de novo MSI-high metastatic endometrial cancer, initially treated with carboplatin, paclitaxel, pembrolizumab. She has progression of disease 9 months into her maintenance pembrolizumab. So any theories as to why some of these MSI-high tumors do not respond to IO? I can start because we actually did have a theory that sadly was wrong. So we looked at this in our DUO-E study, which is the study that Floor mentioned with durvalumab and olaparib, and we thought maybe the proportion of patients, that 25% of patients that progress fairly early, that have progression fairly early, it might be that they were MSI-high but had TMB low, and that was not the case. There was no kind of association between that lack of benefit or lack of response and TMB. So a sad hypothesis put down. Any other thoughts, you guys, about what might be causing this? Brian, do you have something?
Yeah, last year you and I talked about we critically analyzed the ATTEND data where they looked at aneuploidy score.
Yeah.
And as a way to maybe predict those patients, exactly what you said, drop off and don't respond to IO with the DMMR tumors. That may be... there's definitely a subset, and if we could identify that subset, then we could predict which ones shouldn't get IO. I think we're far away from that, but you know, if we can get that answer, that'll be
perfect. Or might need a combination strategy or something else to sensitize, right? If we could figure out what was causing that resistance, innate, unexpected resistance, then you know, then perhaps we could move on to something else. Okay, so progressive disease, 9 months into maintenance pembro. Floor, what would you give this patient in the second-line setting? And specifically, this clinician wanted to know if there was any role for ipilimumab and nivolumab.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a hard one because I think two things. Did she initially respond and then developed progressive disease? I think that makes a difference. Because if they did have an initial response, there may be a role for re-challenging, but then with a combination that's currently under study also, whether if you can re-challenge these patients again. Usually we want to have some kind of interval in between of immunotherapy-free, but there's, I mean, not unreasonable. Some people have tried adding lenvatinib to it, and can you resensitize those patients again with an anti-angiogenic? If the patient never really responded, I think I'm going to come off and do something different other than IO. This is not our thing in that case.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would agree. I mean, the role of IO, after IO, I'm not a big fan what you're alluding to in that one case series by Peter Rose and other smaller series. There's some evidence of adding lenvatinib you're alluding to, but same thing, I agree with you. Someone who's on IO who fails, I'm not a big fan of that.
Yeah. All right, last case. 79-year-old, locally advanced uterine serous cancer, a 3 cm cervical mass with bilateral parametrial involvement fixed in the pelvis, P53 mutant, mismatch repair deficient, PD-L1 negative, HER2 negative, has a history of coronary artery disease, status post CABG and stent, peripheral vascular disease, bypass. You can see she has a lot of medical problems, people. So she was treated with neoadjuvant carboplatin, paclitaxel, and pembrolizumab with the hope of potentially turning resectable. So in patients with locally advanced endometrial cancer that's initially unresectable, the NCCN suggests either neoadjuvant radiation or neoadjuvant chemotherapy. How do you all decide what approach to take? And are there any molecular factors that maybe guide you? Flora, do you want to...
Sure.
Tell us what you do.
I mean, this is a weird one. That she's DMMR and uterine serous and P53 mutated. We usually don't see that. It makes you wonder, like, does she have a P53 mutation? Oh, sorry, a poly mutation.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
So maybe she's PMMR. It really doesn't matter. We have good options now. And so I personally treat these with systemic disease. With systemic therapy. Yeah. So she gets carboplatin, paclitaxel, and immunotherapy. And so we used to like kind of go to surgery as soon as possible, but now with such good results, and these usually respond actually quite well. Oftentimes now I go on to 6 cycles and then decide to do a minimally invasive hysterectomy at the end, because in most instances, their systemic disease, if they have any, will resolve. Local disease also, and they usually become resectable. So if not, then I'll use radiation, but for this patient, I would not treat her. In the past, we may have treated these patients more like a advanced cervical cancer patient, but I think with what we have available and the addition of immunotherapy now, it really has shifted.
Yeah. Do you have a comment?
Yeah, just, you know, remember, we see this not often, but DMMR and P53 mutated, what's her classification? Remember I mentioned earlier, it's hierarchical testing.
Right.
So it's poly, and if she's not poly, which it could be, but a lot of times poly or PMMRs, but it could be poly, then it goes to DMMR. And if she's DMMR testing, if she's DMMR, for classification purposes, you're done.
She's
a DMMR tumor. So I would give Ruby or GY018 and hopefully a hazard ratio of 0.3.
Awesome. Okay, well... Great cases, great discussion. Appreciate my friends here. We're going to go on to module 2, which we're going to be talking a little bit about some different combination strategies. And this is really going to jump off after what Flora just talked about, where we're certainly seeing what we need to see in mismatch repair deficient, although there are some potentials to improve. But also, we really have an unmet need and opportunities for improvement with the mismatch repair proficient disease. And so are there types of combination strategies that we can use to really maximize benefit in this patient population? So first, let's talk a little bit about DuoE, right? So this is what Flora has already referenced. This was our study where we wanted to see if the combination of PARP with IO could potentially improve outcomes in endometrial cancer. And this wasn't simply a case of we have these two drugs, let's put them together and we see what happens. We actually had some really interesting data to support the use of PARP inhibitors. The first was we did a pretty extensive Cell9 study. And of course, cell lines are only as good as they can be. But we saw that there was a high proportion of endometrial cell lines that were sensitive to BMN 673, which is talazoparib, a PARP inhibitor. And we started digging in on the different mechanisms of potential benefit or how we could get potential response or success from a PARP inhibitor. And these are all mechanisms of homologous recombination deficiency that can sometimes sensitize a tumor. And that includes a different lots of different mutations in the homologous recombination pathway, right? So RAD51D, RAD51C, of course, BRCA. But also other aberrations that could potentially sensitize, like somatic mutations or promoter methylation, things like that. We wondered how many of those things are actually happening in endometrial cancer. And further, I think many of you are very familiar with the so-called homologous recombination deficiency score. These are commercially available assays where we can test for HRD in our tumors with a combination of telomeric allelic imbalance, loss of heterozygosity, and large-scale state transitions. And we were interested because, you know, you get these tests, right? And if you test your patients with endometrial cancer, you do get a score for HRD, but is this actually relevant? We looked at it in endometrial cancer cell lines and saw, well, interestingly, if we have a score that is consistent with so-called homologous recombination deficiency, it can potentially predict response to platinum, response to PARP inhibitors, although this really hasn't moved into prime time. And frankly, the cutoffs that we use for ovarian cancer may not be relevant for endometrial cancer. So there's a lot of opportunity to improve here. We've also seen some really interesting data, and Floor showed you that aberrations in ARID1A are quite common in endometrial cancer, and those potentially can sensitize endometrial cancer to PARP inhibitors. And then, of course, so if you put all of this in aggregate, and I'm not even going to go into the PI3 kinase P10 data, which are quite controversial, but might actually predict benefit from PARP, we were looking at least 50%, maybe even 77% of tumors with endometrial cancer that could potentially benefit from PARP. And so we put that together in a phase 3 study. And of course, one of the major areas that we were looking at for this phase 3 study is to understand the role of the PD-L1 inhibitor durvalumab in combination with chemo. But we also added on an additional arm where we put on that olaparib as a maintenance in those patients that made it through that first chemotherapy phase with some kind of benefit. And it was dual primary endpoints we were looking at. It's important to know this. We looked at the Durva arm versus control and then the Durva olaparib arm versus control. And those were the two statistical endpoints. We could compare the Durva olaparib to Durva, but we did not have statistical power, and that becomes important. Now, the bottom line is we saw benefit, and you saw this from Floor, where when we added durvalumab to chemotherapy based on the mechanisms of action that she described so eloquently, we did see an improvement in progression-free survival in the group that got durva in mismatch or pair proficient. I'm not talking to you about deficient. She well covered that. We're talking about the proficient population where we think we have the unmet need. So we saw benefit there in progression-free survival, a reduction in the risk of progression of about 25%. However, when we add that maintenance phase of olaparib, what we think is we're inducing DNA damage, we're stimulating the STING pathway, allowing for immune activation. So we have a pretty neat idea about mechanism of action and why adding olaparib at that place can help with maintenance and actually may even be a form of treatment. And what we saw was an incremental improvement in progression-free survival in that population that got all the drugs. And I didn't have time to go through that right now, but we saw some really neat ctDNA data that showed that those patients that got the durvalumab and olaparib continued to clear their ctDNA positivity and had less reversion from negativity to positivity. So giving us an intriguing idea of who might benefit. Now, we've done a lot of work in biomarkers. We still have a long way to go, right? Because we started with very simplistic biomarkers. I think we all would agree mismatch repair proficient is a very big group, right? We know there are some that are going to be driven by hormonal aberrations. There's some that are going to be driven by HER2, KRAS, ARID1A. So right now we're lumping and we're working more towards splitting. When we tried to tease out who seemed to be benefiting from the molecular standpoint from the combination of durva and olaparib, you can see in general the forest plots favored durva and olaparib pretty much across the board, but especially in those tumors that had BRCA aberrations, patients with genetic aberrations in BRCA, and also P53 mutant. Now, still, the P53 wild type is still a hazard ratio of 0.71, nothing to sneeze at. But really, when we looked at that hazard ratio in those patients with P53 mutations, a 0.47 hazard ratio indicates potentially improved benefit. These are hypothesis generating, right? Now, we've seen other proof of principle with the combination of PARP and IO. This was the RUBY-2 study, which was dostarlimab and niraparib. Please note, this was separate from the RUBY-1 study. It was separately enrolled. So it was chemotherapy with or without dostarlimab plus niraparib. There was no middle arm there, and there's no PARP alone arm in either one of these studies. And they looked at progression-free survival and did found an improvement in progression-free survival with that combination in that mismatch repair proficient group. We just saw the data, though, for overall survival, and we're still waiting on these mature data from DuoE, but we did not see an improvement in overall survival in mismatch repair proficient. And in fact, those curves are crossing fairly aggressively there. So a little bit more to understand about what the potential role for the combination of PARP with an IO and chemotherapy might be. Now, moving on to another combination, one that you already heard about a little bit today, is the combination of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. This has been one of our superstars in second line, with based on really amazing response rates, improvement in progression-free and overall survival. And these were the most recent data presented by Vicky Makker at the IGCS meeting in 2025, which demonstrated a five-year continued improvement in overall survival with the combination of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab as compared to physician's choice chemotherapy, which for this study was weekly paclitaxel or doxorubicin. And this was across all of the population, but of course the PMMR population is the big driver and the population that we're most concerned with. And of course we saw as well progression-free survival benefit that continued as well, although I think we would all agree overall survival is exciting. But this isn't so easy sometimes, right? And I know many of you are experienced clinicians and have been giving this out in the community, and you could talk about this as much as I could. We saw a high proportion of patients that required dose reductions, dose interruptions, and unfortunately, dose discontinuations. And that's exactly the opposite of what we want. We have a successful therapy here in the second line. We want to be able to give these patients this therapy, and we want to give it successfully. So there's got to be ways that we work to manage and mitigate these strategies. And of course, Flora already mentioned, we wanted to see if maybe this combination would outperform chemotherapy. Could we utilize a more targeted strategy in an upfront setting? And I think we all, I mean, I don't know, I thought this was going to be positive. I was kind of surprised. Maybe I'm just a naive gal, but you know, this combination of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab versus paclitaxel carboplatin, they were looking for the dual primary endpoints of progression-free survival as well as overall survival. And as Dr. Backus already showed us, there was no difference, no difference in progression-free survival or overall survival. So what does this tell us about when we're using lenvatinib and pembrolizumab? Well, they did a pretty nice little subgroup. This was a Christian Marth's work where they looked at the group with the prior neoadjuvant or adjuvant therapy, chemotherapy subgroup. And just to kind of level set, this is where we are, right? This is second line, right? This is a population that has gotten chemo already, and then they were ran, and they had, you know, some benefit, had some break, had a recurrence, and then were enrolled on this study, right? So it's a smaller portion of the main population. And what they found is for the patients that had already had chemotherapy, there was a benefit to lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. So what does this tell us? Well, this makes us feel content, right? Second line, that's exactly what this was. And so there was PFS and OS, and again, exploratory analysis, but we already know there's PFS and OS in the second line for this regimen. So this is really helpful. Now, what we don't know is what do we do with this regimen if someone's already had IO? And we started kind of talking about that with the questions from the community, but we don't have data to say how active this regimen is going to be if someone has been on immunotherapy in the front line with chemotherapy. So that is an unmet need and an unanswered question. I always, whenever I talk about lenvatinib and pembrolizumab and toxicity, I always put this up. This is the best paper. Vicky Makker wrote this in The Oncologist. This is an awesome reference. We used to, when we first started giving LenPem, we had this up in our clinic to remind us of the toxicities and when they might occur and how we might mitigate them. And this is just for your reference, some specific ways that we can actually manage some of the toxicities that we encounter for lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. For hypertension, we employ daily monitoring. We send them home with a blood pressure cuff, and actually many of the times we'll give them a prescription for an antihypertensive that they can take with them. Diarrhea, the key is reporting, right? Like, we need to know as soon as it's happening, use those antimotility agents fairly early, definitely dose interrupt, right? You can, and I have another slide on this, you can use the timing to kind of figure out which agent might be driving that diarrhea so you make sure you treat it correctly. Fatigue is tough, right? You rule out the other causes, you check for anemia, and you do the exact opposite of what they feel like doing and tell them to exercise. But that really is one of the best ways to kind of counteract that adverse event. And really, liberal use of interruptions and reductions is important for true grade 2, grade 3 fatigue where you need recovery. And then nausea, high-fat foods, and small frequent meals are key. This is what I was getting at with the overlapping toxicity. We have a number of toxicities that can be seen with either lenvatinib or pembrolizumab: rash, diarrhea, fatigue. You know, it's really important to understand the timeline, to pause the lenvatinib to see what what resolves and help you make sure that you're treating the patient appropriately. And I think we're going to get into this in some of the case discussions, but there are people that advocate for a lower starting dose, right? A way to kind of give the patient a still active but lower dose that might help mitigate or avoid some of the toxicities. Early recognition is key, clarifying your cause, and then really determining inpatient versus outpatient management, if they need corticosteroids, all of those types of things. But with these types of strategies, we can successfully keep patients on a really effective therapy. So I think now we're going to transition into some very fun case discussion. So I'll start here. It's a 67-year-old woman, stage 4B, mismatch repair proficient endometrioid endometrial cancer, both lung and omental metastases. BMI of 38, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, treated with first-line carboplatin, paclitaxel, and pembrolizumab. There's a partial response, but then she experiences disease progression at 14 months with new liver metastases. So then she gets second-line lenvatinib and pembrolizumab and develops grade 3 hypertension, grade 2 proteinuria, has a lenvatinib dose reduction to 14 and then to 10. So I think this is a great kind of question, and this came right from our community around how do people start their, what do they start their lenvatinib dose? How do they titrate? Do you start low and escalate? Do you start high and reduce? You know, what, Brian, what's your strategy?
Yeah, no, we talk about this a lot. I don't know if I'm old school or I start at 20 and then I go down very liberally, mm-hmm. right? I could go down very, very quickly. But the reason why I start at 20 is I'm afraid to give a lower dose to a patient who doesn't have side effects, where there's no activity, and then I'll say it doesn't work, but that may be the suboptimal dose.
Right.
So I start, and of course there are frail patients. There's some exceptions. I don't want to say in every patient, but in general, I like to start at 20 and go down pretty quickly as needed.
Yeah. How about you, Flor?
I do the same thing. I think there's some data out there, indeed, that's for the TKIs, that it is important to get those receptor fully saturated. And then in what you're saying, like adjust based on your toxicity. Sometimes, like just for practical purposes, we may start, and pills obviously come in 10 and 4s, sometimes add 18 milligrams so that you can easily go from, if they have an issue, that you can easily go from 18 to 14. That is off-label, just to make sure that that's clear. But sometimes patients have, it's not as easy to get their prescription, get to the pharmacy, get those adjustments, so that helps. But I think the more important thing also is, yes, I do like to start high and then go lower. The other thing, I think, before you start these patients, make sure that their pre-existing hypertension is already adequately treated, that you have them optimized before they get started. Some people will argue, give them a prescription with, I don't know if you do this, but a prescription for an antihypertensive to go home with. Yeah. I usually tell them, like, here's your blood pressure log, send us your blood pressure in. And some of the remote monitoring also has helped with this, that we can now do and set the alarms for the patient, and the remote monitoring system will notify us.
Great. So this is the same case. So we talked a little bit about where we start our dose and dose modification. Are there specific strategies for side effect prevention and management that you recommend to safely, effectively employ? So you mentioned giving out antihypertensives for that. You know, Brian, do you do anything specific for the potential for diarrhea with this regimen?
Yeah, I think, and I alluded to this earlier, with the combination, once they develop diarrhea, we really need to differentiate if it's from the lenvatinib or from the pembrolizumab. So in these cases, I don't do a lot besides for education to prevent it. We educate them. But if there is a diarrhea, what I'll usually do, I'll stop lenvatinib. Mm-hmm. If it resolves, then I know where it's from. If it doesn't resolve, then I sort of know it's from pembrolizumab, and then treat it appropriately from there.
Yeah, great. I think, you know, from a fatigue standpoint, prevention's tough. Exercise seems to be helpful. Like if you can get that patient up and moving and active, that sometimes can help counteract. Obviously, keeping an eye on bone marrow, anemia, things like that, and helping them, you know, try to prevent that as much as possible is helpful. But I personally find with fatigue, that is the side effect that makes me dose hold and dose reduce the most. I mean, I think of all of them. I think everything else, I feel like I can get patients through it, but the fatigue, you need to give them a little bit of a break.
Yeah,
and it's really hard. I would just say, don't just dose reduce, like give them that week or two off to let them kind of recalibrate, get their energy back up, and then restart it at a lower dose so that they can really have more energy, hopefully, to start. So same patient. So now we've got a patient with PMMR, who's having progression on chemo IO. So we talked a little bit about this, the IO challenge. I think you guys both said you're open to it. You're not really sure what to do. But what about third line? So say we gave the chemo IO, we had progression of disease, we gave lenvatinib and pembro, maybe had some success, and then what are we thinking around for third line in this setting?
I think this is where definitely want to make sure that we know what their HER2 status is. If they were negative, I would consider re-biopsying it. Because we do see that, I mean, it can go both ways, but if they're HER2, say, 0 or 1 plus, if they now become 2 plus on your next biopsy, they are eligible to receive trastuzumab deruxtecan. Otherwise, certainly there's a lot of other ADC trials that are available. If they're not at your institution, then I'm sure there's at least one, if not multiple, in the vicinity at other institutions. So we have so many options.
Yeah, and
now,
I know Brian's going to talk about that in his talk, so we'll let him have that detail. So this is a new patient. 67-year-old woman, metastatic endometrial cancer, mismatch repair proficient, declines chemotherapy. Treated with frontline lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, now with stable disease. So, Flora, do you agree with first-line lenvatinib and pembro in this situation, given the refusal of chemo?
Yeah, I think that LEAP-001 supports it. It was not better. It was not superior, but it was no different, really, than chemotherapy. So I think that's a reasonable approach.
Yeah. Brian, you mentioned that you might think of other strategies. Anything else you would do here besides len-pem?
Yeah, I think, in this patient, I think lenvatinib pembrolizumab is a good first option here. I think also, you know, depending on her molecular profiling, we could do, if she's HER2, it was alluded to trastuzumab deruxtecan. If she's ER positive or some hormonal therapy, but she's already I think unlikely here. But I think, the key error, hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah.
The error to LEAP-001 is that it was a superiority trial, not an inferiority trial.
Yeah.
It's inferiority trials would require a lot more patients, things like that. But if it was, it would have been a positive trial.
Right. And then it would have been a question of adverse events. And I do think the time, right? I mean, I think that was always my concern if LEAP-001 was positive is, you know, with chemotherapy, you have kind of an end game, although now we add immunotherapy to it, so it takes a little long. But lenvatinib and pembrolizumab was going to be a couple of years. So I did wonder about having patients on a therapy for so long, like what was the needed benefit for that? But I agree with you. I think it would have been ideal if it was a non-inferiority trial, we would have had a lot of answers. Now, would you give, if this patient was the same patient but was mismatch repair deficient, would you do single agent IO for her? Either one of you, I don't know. Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I would give single agent IO. And then, you know, one question could be, well, why not LenPem? Because there were DMMR patients in the LenPem trial, and there was an advantage. But the hazard ratio there is 0.6.
Yeah.
Hazard ratio of, you know, the response rate of single agent IO is pretty low. I would probably go single agent here because I think that's the bang for your buck.
Yeah. And Flor, what about for a poly mutant? Would you give IO?
With metastatic disease, I don't think we're there yet. We treat those the same. I think where poly plays a role, as we said in the beginning, is the early stage where we are starting to explore, can we de-escalate?
Okay. So this is a different patient, 58-year-old woman, stage 3C2, serous endometrial cancer with periaortic nodal metastases, mismatch repair proficient, TP53 abnormal, BRCA1 somatic mutation, undergoes a debulking surgery, and has frontline carboplatin, paclitaxel, and dostarlimab with complete response after 6 cycles, then started on maintenance with dostarlimab and niraparib, tolerated very well for 10 months, then developed recurrent disease, peritoneal carcinomatosis. So would you have done this, Brian? Would you have considered dostarlimab and niraparib for this patient?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I wouldn't use dostarlimab and niraparib. There's some data, but your data is better when you talk about IO and PARP inhibition. In general, I don't recommend DuoE yet because we also don't have an FDA approval. It's on NCCN,
sure,
but we don't have FDA approval.
Right, there it is NCCN listed.
But yeah. I've used it 4 times with BRCA mutations. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if it works any better or not, but that just makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So
that population did seem to benefit the most, although it was a very small population, so you have to be very careful when you look at those data. But, you know, I think it's a reasonable thing. It's a targeted therapy, and we've proven that BRC aberrations seem to be associated with benefit from PARP. Yep. But say this was your patient, Flor, what would you do now? Got dostarlimab and niraparib, or maybe durvalumab and olaparib, and then has recurrent disease. What would you do?
Other than trastuzumab deruxtecan, we don't really have good active agents here that we have approval for in this population. So she has a pretty good chance to be HER2 positive, either 2+ or 3+. So she would have access to T-DXd in that case. If not, and she doesn't have a clinical trial available, then we're down to weekly Taxol or doxorubicin, which is sad. Like, we've made so much progress,
yeah,
but then all of a sudden we use all these agents up front and then we're done.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need more.
I would do the same. Maybe I'd add Bev to the weekly Taxol just to...
Yeah. Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
So current role, I think we kind of already started covering this a little bit. Current role of PARP inhibition and BRCA-mutated endometrial cancer... Sounds like you're still waiting to kind of use it for everybody, but potentially for the right patient, you might consider it off-label. What about mismatch repair proficient tumors more broadly, given that they don't necessarily benefit as much from chemo IO? Would you consider, is there any population you would consider PARP and IO for, Flor? It's okay to say no. I'm not going to say offended.
Yeah, same. I haven't really used it
in
combination that frequently for this. I think there's other studies that hopefully, Brian, you'll touch on, that we're waiting for those results and maybe get some strong data there, that we have some other options than just IO alone. But this is still a population of very high need.
Yeah, and I think from the ctDNA standpoint, you know, we did, you know, look at this with DuoE, and the patients with positive ctDNA at the completion of chemo and IO seem to benefit the most from the addition of PARP. It seemed to help them clear. They had durable benefit and response. So that may be a population that we can utilize ctDNA to help guide our therapy, but it's a little bit too early. Okay, here's another patient. 55-year-old woman with advanced mismatch repair proficient endometrial cancer, somatic BRCA2 mutation, completes 6 cycles of carboplatin and paclitaxel and started on maintenance olaparib. On cycle 3, she develops grade 2 anemia with a hemoglobin of 8.2, nausea, and moderate fatigue. So do you support this approach, Brian, or is IO absolutely necessary? If you're going to do it, do you want to do it with combo?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in this setting, I think olaparib makes sense, but the data we have, and one could argue that it's, you know, I commended you on your trial. Maybe there was a missing arm of PARP alone as opposed to, so,
yeah.
But in the absence of data, I would give durvalumab with the olaparib in this patient. Mm-hmm.
And so expected toxicities requiring dose modifications or supportive care with PARP inhibitor maintenance in endometrial cancer. So, Flor, how often do you, let's say just for PARP in general, since mm-hmm. you've said that you don't use this in endometrial cancer, yeah. how often are you monitoring your hematologic parameters in this patient population?
For olaparib, niraparib is a little bit different. We would check it weekly as they just get started for that first month at least because of the risk of thrombocytopenia and other hematologic side effects also. But with olaparib, I typically just do every 4 weeks. If she's coming in for chemotherapy every 3 weeks, then obviously we check just with that. I think the other important part, which I've started to do more, is just checking also their iron studies. And a lot of these women actually are iron deficient. They may have had bleeding. They have nutritional deficiencies. So rather than frequent transfusions, which we used to do more, now we are much more apt to give iron infusions also, especially when they're iron, obviously when they're iron deficient also. But supplementing these women also, when they're long time on these agents, is going to be really important.
Yeah. And, you know, as far as dosage of olaparib, when you're giving it with durvalumab, we start at 300, you reduce it accordingly. Yep. You know, if you've got a hemoglobin of 8.2, you don't necessarily have to dose reduce, but maybe in the setting of the fatigue and the other symptoms, that would, you know, likely be ideal. Any data to support re-challenge after treatment interruption? I think in this case, yeah, sure.
I would drop it.
Yeah, if you've already made the decision to get a PARP, to have a PARP inhibitor, you know, get them through that fatigue. Like I said, interruptions can be really helpful there, and then consider the dose interruption. You know, from the standpoint of anemia, I think, you know, Flor's thoughts around iron studies is really essential. We are starting to use IV iron a lot more than we used to, and I think it's really helping our patient population. Would you ever switch to an alternative PARP inhibitor? So say, you know, Brian, you had this patient and getting olaparib and you're having all these issues. Would you consider switching to something else like niraparib?
Yeah, I think, you know, I do. I think that the different PARP inhibitors do have different side effect mm-hmm. profiles. Not so much IO. I think it's a class effect. But for PARP inhibitors, I've done that before. If there's GI side effects, I switch to once daily dosing with niraparib. If there's issue with platelets, I'll go away from niraparib and go for olaparib. But yeah, in general.
Yeah, you can definitely do that. All right. Well, let's move on now. We've been hinting at some of the different agents that are under investigation for advanced endometrial cancer. And Dr. Slomovitz is going to take us through.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it. You know, ASCO is such a busy meeting, and it's so tough to go through your entire day, you know, to be here at night and to be with us to learn. We really appreciate it. And for me, it's an honor to be working with both Flor and Shannon here. So it's a great opportunity. This is something I'm really passionate about. You know, not we talked about what we're doing for endometrial cancer. Now we have to talk about where we're going, right? What trials are ongoing, what trials have maybe read out, or we have some preliminary signals and we need to learn more about it, and you know, where's really the direction going? I work down in Miami Beach. This is a picture of my hospital down on the beach. So come down and visit anytime you'd like. So let's start off, let's conceptualize what we're going to go through. First, you know, there's going to be a lot of ADC in this talk. But before I talk about the antibody drug conjugates, I want to talk to you about some other options that we're looking at in advanced and recurrent disease. Options that may change the way we treat these patients in the very near future. Now, we talked earlier, we mentioned IO is the option for DMMR, but in PMMR, it is a option, and let's see what maybe some of the other options are. So in this cartoon, we're looking at a picture of it's selinexor, it's a targeted nuclear transport inhibitor. Basically, I like to keep it very simple. Basically, what it does is it prevents proteins from leaving the cell, it keeps the P53 in, whether it's mutated or not, whether it's wild type. Nuclear retention and functional reactivation of the tumor suppressor genes, which selectively kill cancer cells, inhibition of mRNA export of select oncogenes, and simultaneous targeting of several oncogenic pathways. So we did a study looking at carboplatin paclitaxel induction, and then it was a maintenance trial, it's called the SIENDO trial, and this is for all comers, giving patients, randomizing them to selinexor or to placebo. And what we saw here was on the left in the ITT population, bottom line, it was a negative trial. Mm-hmm. But a pre-specified endpoint, no alpha was assigned to it, but a pre-specified endpoint Looking at P53 wild type is shown on the right. And the long-term outcome there showed a hazard ratio of 0.44, benefiting those patients with P53 wild type tumors, the addition of selinexor. So what do we do? It wasn't pre-specified, not statistically significant for that subgroup. So we're doing the trial now. This is called the EXPORT trial. It's actually closed to accrual. All right, but what this is looking at the P53 wild type population, carboplatin paclitaxel induction, randomizing to selinexor versus placebo, and we'll see what these results show. I don't know the results. I'm optimistic, right? Siendo 0.44. If it gets close, remember this: the studies that were shown, PMMR 0.54 or higher. So, you know, maybe it can become an option for this population of patients. So that's one, you know, one concept I want to just highlight there is using a normal biomarker as a biomarker we use. So not all biomarkers we use have to be the abnormal ones. P53 wild type, it could be a biomarker for treatment with selinexor. We'll see how the results play out. We alluded a little bit to the use of bevacizumab. This is a GOG86P. It was a 3-arm randomized phase 2 trial led by Carol Agajanian. And in one of the arms was carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab. And in this post-study analysis, what they found was that in the P53 wild-type patients, the addition of bevacizumab performed better than more historical controls. So maybe we don't need IO for the PMMR. Maybe we need bevacizumab in the first line, reserving Len-Pem with an OS advantage in 775 for the second line. So based on this, and here's two trials that are, one's ongoing, they're both in the public domain. On the left, Florin nicely began to highlight this. What's an, I can't read, 35, GY035? Yeah. GY035, 3-arm trial. Okay, carboplatin paclitaxel pembrolizumab, that's the control arm. Carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab. Now, if that arm wins, it's getting rid of IO. And the third arm is looking at the combination, carboplatin, paclitaxel, pembro, bevacizumab. Ongoing trial, NRG, very, very important trial. We'll see how that plays out to reintroduce the role of VEGF inhibition in the first-line management of this disease. Now, the study on the right is a new asset from Pfizer. We're going to be running this one through GOG Partners. It's looking at a bispecific, a VEGF-PD-1 bispecific. So it's giving us that dual inhibition. The study designed carboplatin, paclitaxel, pembrolizumab, versus carboplatin paclitaxel with its bispecific. This isn't going to get rid of IO, but it's going to see if by adding VEGF in the bispecific to the IO, we can get an advantage. This one's going to be led by Katie Moore. The one on the left is going to be led by Amanda Nichols-Fader. And we're excited about this for a couple of reasons. And again, one of my jobs I didn't mention, I help lead the uterine cancer portfolio for the GOG. It's a trial without an ADC. I'll talk to you about the ADC trials, but we have so many ADC trials, it's sort of refreshing. ADC, and this is a laundry list, right? TROP2s, sacituzumab, I'll go through this as we go forward. Sacituzumab govitecan, sac-TMT, trastuzumab deruxtecan. There's the BioNTech asset for HER2 expression, which Flora knows very, very well. She's the PI of the trial. The MoRes, there's data that I'll show you. The puxisam, B7H4 target. Alpha folate receptors are still available and looking at in endometrial cancers as well. At this point, you're at ASCO, you know what an ADC is, 3 components. The target, the antibody that binds to the antigen on the cell, the kill, the payload. Most of these are going to be topo-1s, which, they're the same. And obviously the linker, the most important point, holds on into the bloodstream. Let's go when it's at the tumor. So, it's tough, really, to look at individual phase 2 activity trials and to compare them. It's really tough. But you could see here, this is the comparative overall response rates across trials. We could see in the TDXD on the left, all comers, 57%, HER2 3 plus, unprecedented, 85%. All right, the Traz-Pimir, that's the other HER2 that we're investigating, 47% in the all-comers. And the HER2 3 positive, 73%. It's a viable pathway, exploited in the HER2 pathway. Sacituzumab govitecan, sac-TMT, the TROP2, talk about that in a couple minutes. The B7H4 is MoRAS, the PSAM, and finally the RENA-S. All these are really 67% for MoRAS. We saw that a couple weeks ago at the SGO meeting. Yesterday we saw PSAM 47%, I think, in endometrial cancer. Let's go through the data quickly, and the data will be what I'll use to support where the trials are and where the FDA indications are. So again, if you've been to ASCO ever, and if you don't know this data, you're not going to the meeting because everyone, Pan Tumor Destiny 2, This is what we really redefined in a lot of ways, how we're treating a lot of diseases, particularly the GYN cancers, endometrial, ovarian, cervix. And the most robust data was seen in the endometrial cohort. It's most highly expressed in the endometrial cancer patients. Really unprecedented response rates in the 3+ and the 2+. Small numbers, and I get it. If you argue, well, the small numbers, there are. FDA approval in 3+ for pan-solid tumors. NCCN listing 2+ and 3+. FDA granted approval. So what we're doing now, based on that data, okay, so, and I'll talk later about the second line studies, but we're, just like anything else, we're moving second line studies to the first line and earlier. So this is an interesting study. This is a study that's being led by Vicky Macker, really one of the leaders in our field, looking at moving T-DXd to the first line as a treatment. All right, this is a treatment study, and later I'll show you a maintenance study. Standard of care is arm C, carboplatin, paclitaxel, pembrolizumab. Arm B is looking at trastuzumab deruxtecan. This patient population is 2+ or 3+, plus pembrolizumab, getting rid of carbotaxel in the first line. How cool would that be? And arm A is looking at a new bispecific. It's a PD-L1 with a TIGIT with trastuzumab deruxtecan. Open, ongoing study. We really need patients to accrue. So if you're involved with research or if you have a nearby site, please consider sending your patients to this trial. Not only are we looking at T-DXd in the first line, we're looking at it in the adjuvant setting. This is DESTINY-02, GOG-3122, led by Karen Matthews at Brown University. We know from B21, we didn't talk about it a lot, but B21 was an adjuvant trial, which was negative, leaving the standard of care to be carboplatin paclitaxel. So this is an adjuvant study, HER2 2+ or 3+, giving trastuzumab deruxtecan, you don't need pembro in the setting, versus carboplatin paclitaxel. How cool is it going to be? Not only do we get rid of chemo in the adjuvant setting, but we can get an ADC going in the adjuvant setting. When we designed this trial, it was a lot of like the blind leading the blind. We settled on a duration of therapy of 12 months. This study allows for radiation as well. Really, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. The TROP2, SAC-TMT, this is the TROP2, this is the Merck asset, the humanized anti-TROP2 antibody. I don't want to go through too much. Unique bifunctional linker, cytotoxic payload, these are all TOPO1s. This is an early study, a phase 1-2 activity trial that was done, basically showing the results here of SAC-TMT with a confirmed overall response rate of 31%, okay, across the different doses, unconfirmed 35%, disease control rate of 75%, showing activity in endometrial cancer. The toxicity profile is shown here, and obviously we watched this closely. Last week, I think it was a week ago Monday, Merck released a press release. SAC-TMT hit the triple. OS, PFS, response rate, significant advantages. We don't know what the data is. If you read the press release, it says in select populations, and that's okay. They say they're going to announce it in a future meeting. They'll present it in a future meeting. And the only other thing that's in the public domain is with SAC-TMT, they applied for this. It's called a priority voucher review. So we'll get a somewhat expedited FDA. The FDA is waiting for the data to hopefully get it soon quick. That's all we know. This was the design. This was led by globally Ketila Russo. In the U.S., it was led by Bob Nepithuri from NYU. So we know we're testing in the second line. We're going to test in the first line. I showed you the treatment trial, TROPHES-033, led by Brad Monk. This is a maintenance trial. All patients get carboplatin, paclitaxel, pembrolizumab in the induction. Then they're randomized to stay on pembro alone or pembro and SAC-TMT. This is open and accruing in the U.S., and it'll be interesting to see if we introduce ADCs, is it going to be replacing chemo or just in the maintenance setting? This is sacituzumab govitecan, the Gilead asset, TROP2 ADC, showing really nice, there's a nice spider plot here in waterfall curves. The response rates here in preliminary work sort of 22% response rate. Stable disease, 44%, good clinical benefit rate. This is a study that's being led by Ramez Iskander, GOG Partners trial, close to accrual. We're waiting for the results. Second line trial to see if ADCs belong in the second line. This is another TROP2 ADC. I mentioned this earlier. This is the T-Pemirectin. This is the BioNTech HER2 expressing recurrent endometrial cancer trial. This is the data showing this is different between trastuzumab deruxtecan. It may work in 1+ as well. So Flora knows this one very, very well. She's leading our phase 3 recurrent trial. All of these trials, we have to look at toxicity profile. right? We don't have that yet, but all of these trials, we lifted a toxicity profile. So we'll see how this plays out. Mores, GSK5733584. This is a B7H4 ADC. We thought we saw good response rates until this was presented at the SGO. 67% response rate in endometrial cancer, presented by Anna Oaknin. Obviously, we're going to develop this further. Puxisam, this is the B7H4 from that Stephanie Gayard's leading phase 2 activity trial. This is last year's data presented yesterday. They updated it mid to late 40% response rate, another active agent in this disease. And finally, Rinibart, sesutecan, it's the alpha folate receptor, 50% response rate in phase 2 activity trials. So here's where we stand, and this is, I think, one of my last slides. Here's where we stand. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. All right, we already have one FDA approval for etrusumab deruxtecan, FDA approved. Two of these are closed out, one with a press release, the two TROP2s. Other ones that are biomarker specific, the HER2, trastuzumab, TAZPAM, the puxisam B7H4, a lot of these are tumor agnostic as well. We need sites to contribute, we need sites to accrue, but the future is really bright moving forward with ADCs. Thanks for your time.
Great job. So we've got some great discussion questions that were contributed, and we also have some from the audience. I'm going to try to cover as much as we can in this last 15 minutes of everyone's time, and really thank you for all of these amazing questions. So first, I think this one's a good one. It covers some of what's been asked from the audience as well. So it's a 58-year-old woman, advanced microsatellite stable endometrial cancer, P53 wild type. So this clinician was wondering if you, as faculty, are testing for aberrant P53 in all of your patients at initial diagnosis or only certain ones like this patient with microsatellite stable disease. Flora, what are you doing?
Yeah, for us it kind of comes PR, P53, yeah. Mismatch repair proficient, comes on whatever the pathologist does. So we don't have to request it separately. And if your pathologist is not testing it, it is the recommended panel that should be done for all patients per the WHO standards and the pathology reporting also. So, yeah, we usually have this data. It's easy. It's immunohistochemistry.
And as far as when things are going to get reported, the answer is soon. We're hoping very soon we should be hearing about the selinexor data that Brian mentioned. But, you know, we do use a lot of off-label. Do you guys, should we be trying to get selinexor, Brian, for our patients with P53 wild-type disease?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I've done it once. The patient came in educated about it, and we were able to get it because it is an FDA-approved drug. Huh. I'm hesitant to offer it because the dosing is completely different. A lot of the current indications is a much higher dosing is not very, very tolerable.
Okay.
We know what we give lower dose, and on export we give with dual antiemetics, things like that, but I'm not really, unless if I'm pushed, I'm not comfortable giving it.
And would either of you ever give it with an anti-PD-1 or an anti-PD-L1 antibody? Would you try to combine all the things?
No, this time. I don't know. We don't know how strong that benefit is. But we don't want to add additional toxicity if we don't need to. Yeah. So I think we don't have that answer yet. More is not always better.
Yeah. And Brian, you started getting at this and some of the adverse events that you're seeing with selinexor, nausea, counts. Mm-hmm. Anything else that's been a struggle?
Yeah, no, it's nice. You know, a lot of times we hate to do two phase 3 trials, but this one we did. We learned a lot from the Siendo trial. So we lowered the dose, and then you'll say, well, how do you know lower dose works? It's actually using the same median dose as we used in the first trial, but in the first trial they need to be dose reduced.
Yeah.
All right, and then we implemented the dual antiemetics. And overall, I mean, I can't say a lot. I don't know a lot, but my patients that I've had on, they tolerated it pretty well.
Great. So this is a different patient, 58, stage 3, serous endometrial cancer, P53 mutant, mismatch repair proficient, received carboplatin paclitaxel first line, progressed at 10 months, started lenvatinib and pembrolizumab second line with further progression. So what's the next option? And I think, Brian, you talked about the press release. So let me ask Floor, do you think sac-TMT is going to be an option for a patient like this?
Having the triple combination positive, I don't know what's going to happen and what the FDA will rule. It will depend on the data, but you would expect that that's going to be another agent that will be available to our patients probably in the near future. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we kind of got out a little bit about what we know about the other TROP2 ADCs. I think, you know, Brian, have you had any patients on sac-govatecan?
Yeah, no. I had the sac-TMT trial open You know, I know the sites that are accruing nicely, and we'll see. I think the side effect profile we're going to look at just as important as the efficacy data.
Yeah, I mean, we had a couple of patients on the ASCENT trial and had some really nice responses, but it's like you have to be really careful, right? If you put a few patients on, your experience may not be relevant to the entire group. So I think these are active drugs, and you're exactly right. We're going to have to see what the adverse event profile is to really understand who's the best option. So, okay, but we're going to try to push you a little bit. So bear with me. So if we do get, let's say, both TROP2 ADCs into the clinic, who do you think that you're going to use them for, Floor? And for a patient that maybe has progression with that frontline chemoimmunotherapy, is that something that you might do before lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, you know, trying to get away from that IO after IO?
Yeah, I think this is going to be a nice option. I think neither Brian or I are super excited about if you have progression on IO to immediately add lenvatinib, unless maybe it's like tiny little stuff that you think you can overcome. But if they have real progression, you're probably going to need to switch your regimens. So yes, for this, having an ADC that is FDA approved will be nice. I don't know if these are going to be, these will be our first ones probably to be approved. But there's many more to follow. So I suspect so. We don't know if this is going to be our best and longest one, but for now, whatever is going to be available is going to be a good thing. I think we're going to struggle. Like when we have these available in the clinic and we were talking about that, of course, everybody's talking about that at this meeting too. Like, all right, then you're going to give this and now you can't test any of your other ones anymore because you've given your topo ADC already and you're excluded from any of your other options. So, well, time will tell, but yes, I think these are, and you mentioned side effects, schedules, one of them is given every 2 weeks, the other one is given day one, day eight on a 21-day cycle, some of the other ADCs are all on every 3-week cycle, so some of those features also, I think, play a big role in patients, especially patients that are traveling from far or have other things that they want to, activities that they want to maintain. So,
I mean, I think you bring up a really important point and something we don't have the answer to, right? Is this sequencing and is it that you're going to be able to get just one or maybe only two antibody drug conjugates during, you know, your disease continuum? We really don't understand how to sequence. We don't understand resistance mechanisms, right? So certainly if the resistance mechanism is through receptor, then yeah, maybe you can give another antibody drug conjugate. Maybe you move through different agents that have different receptors but the same payload. But if the resistance is related to the payload, which is what you were getting at, Floor, if you've already given your topoisomerase payload, it doesn't matter if you change to a different drug with a different receptor. The cancer is still going to be resistant. And so it really is going to depend. And then if these two TROP2s are in first, right? First to market is always pretty exciting. What are we going to need to see from the subsequent trials that Brian just described to be able to maybe push those out of off the top of the mountain and use, you know, maybe the folate receptor alpha drugs or the B7H4 drug, right? So these are things that, you know, we're asking you all that you all are going to need to start thinking about when we're have all these drugs potentially available. And you're right. You may end up with, you gave that one and, you know, now we're looking towards oral agents, targeted therapies, other things before for these patients. So let's go to a different case. And this case actually overlaps a little bit with something from the audience. So I'm going to try to kind of cover both questions. So the 63-year-old, she's had multiple treatments for metastatic mismatch repair proficient endometrial cancer, HER2 IHC 2+. She received trastuzumab deruxtecan, got meaningful clinical response with improvement in symptoms, reduction in tumor burden, radiographic partial response, which was sustained. So, Brian, for a patient with mismatch repair proficient HER2 positive EC, would you start with carboplatin paclitaxel IO, or would you use trastuzumab as frontline therapy? And do you have any information about how to predict who's going to benefit from what? And would you ever combine all the things?
Yeah, so a couple of things to look at it. You know, there's data about carboplatin paclitaxel trastuzumab. Amanda Nichols-Fader did a multi-site phase 2 study that showed there's an advantage. Following that, Britt Erickson's leading GY026, which is looking at that in a more prospective randomized phase 3 trial. Mm-hmm. And the third point is in the Destiny, pan-tumor Destiny trial, some of those patients who did receive T-DXd did actually have previous use of trastuzumab. All that said, I don't. Typically, I go for chemo IO. Mm-hmm. And I know that the T-DXd rates second line are really good.
Yeah.
So I don't know if giving the trastuzumab is needed. And remember, with trastuzumab, not with T-DXd, but trastuzumab, IHC2+, you need to confirm it by FISH.
That's right.
Not with trastuzumab deruxtecan, but with trastuzumab.
Great point. The molecular testing really matters depending on the drug that you're using. And remember, that was a great phase two with trastuzumab, but it was much, much smaller than these randomized phase three studies that demonstrated that clear, you know, overall survival and progression-free survival benefit. So you just have to be really cautious about the way you're interpreting these data. Now, from the audience, we had a similar patient, 68, HER2 positive, serous cancer, mismatch repair proficient. This patient it was some years ago in 2021, so the patient did get paclitaxel carboplatin and trastuzumab in addition to surgery. 5 years later with recurrence in pelvis and lung. Okay. Lung biopsy still serous, but now HER2 negative. Not enough tissue for NGS. Patient has chronic kidney disease. This is like real life in your clinic. So here, first question, would you give trastuzumab deruxtecan? Recurrent was initially HER2 positive, but on biopsy is HER2 negative. Does that change what you would do, Brian, if you've got current biopsy with HER2 negativity?
Yeah, I mean, I think having trastuzumab deruxtecan in your as part of one of your weapons, I think is very, very important. You know, just because we haven't tested it in endometrial cancer doesn't mean it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I put a great amount of input in my decision-making from what we've done in breast cancer. And we know, as most of you who are medical oncologists in the room, you know, ultra-low, there's a response rate. So I think if you're worried about insurance approval, you have the positive biomarker for 5 years. 5 years ago, I'd be okay using trastuzumab deruxtecan.
And there are some data, obviously, in other tumor types with, you know, trastuzumab deruxtecan working in those really low-expressing tumors. We're trying to generate those data now in endometrial cancer and other tumors, so we may have a leg to stand on. But
in this case, you have a five-year chemo-free interval.
That's what I was going to ask you, yep.
She's never seen IO, and she's now maybe HER2-0. I think this patient also has multiple options.
Yeah.
You could, for the scenario that Brian mentioned, you could consider trastuzumab deruxtecan, but you can also give this patient now chemotherapy with IO. Yeah. It is likely to work again 5 years later.
Yep.
She can also go on lenvatinib pembrolizumab,
exactly.
And the LEAP data of that, which you presented, the prior treatment, there may be benefit there too. So this patient actually has several good options.
This is a fortunate patient. And I will say one of the other questions that was asked from the audience were serous patients included in the lenvatinib pembrolizumab studies? And the answer is yes. And in fact, when it was looked at based on, you know, serous versus clear cell versus others, they had just as much benefit as anyone else. So there was really consistent response rates, consistent progression-free survival, regardless of histology, with that combination of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. So some really great questions from our audience. Okay, so this is the same patient that got trastuzumab deruxtecan, had her meaningful clinical response. So talking about side effects with T-DXd, any tips on managing the nausea, asthenia in those patients, and what's your optimal approach for screening for ILD? Brian, you want to tackle that first?
Yeah, I'll start with the ILD.
Perfect.
I take it very, very, very seriously. And I also, you know, when I wake up in the morning, I look in a mirror, I'm not seeing a pulmonary expert. Okay, so I think in these patients, whether they have early symptoms or if they have early findings on CT scan, those patients go in to see one of my pulmonologists quickly, and I work with him closely. It's not one of the consults that I write a note in Epic, he writes a note in Epic. It's one of the consults I call them up, and I say, what can we do to best get this patient through her treatment and preventing further ILD? Because it's potentially, you know, there's no survival benefit yet, but it's going to help her live a long time if she can get this drug.
Yeah.
So I think that's a super important point. The other side effects, you know, we manage as we typically do, manageable with antiemetics and things like that.
Yeah. And then I think the next question talks a little bit about what we were already kind of covering around the topoisomerase payloads. You know, if you had given this patient trastuzumab deruxtecan, say there ended up being progression of disease, could you potentially consider one of these SAC TMT, the sacovatecan drugs after TDXD. What do you think, Floor?
I think this is going to be a great opportunity for us if we have two and patients that have overlapping eligibility for both, that we actually get real life data, because
yep.
probably pharmaceutical companies are probably not going to study that as much for us, but we can get these patients in real world studies where we can give one and then expose them to something else and see what happens. So that's going to be a really important one.
Yeah. Well, guys, it has flown by. I'm so grateful to both of my amazing faculty members and how well they covered such extensive data and really just covered so many questions. So I hope a lot of your questions were answered. I also want to thank the general medical oncologists that provided all these cases and all of you. I mean, this is the most cases I've ever gotten in anything like this. So I just love how active y'all were. It just makes it so fun for us. And we hope to see you at our next event. Thank you so much. Have a great night. Have a great ASCO.